Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Buongiorno, Black Lives Matter. To all the essential employees, thank you for everything you're doing. Oh, this is an exciting episode. This is an episode, sometimes an episode brews in my heart. Well, first of all, you know what this episode's about because you read the description. It's about The Last of Us 2. And as a nerd with a podcast, sometimes when I'm viewing something or reading something or playing something, I'm drawn to take out my phone and start taking notes. It's just, I don't know, it's the nerd in me. And I started taking notes on this game before even knowing that we were going to do an episode. I'm joined today by my friend Abe Farage. Abe.
Hey there. Great to be on.
Abe, I'm so happy to have you here. I kind of put out feelers on the internet and I was like, is anyone else playing this game? And is there anyone else who wants to talk about it positively? Because we'll get into this more, but a lot of people are fucking hating on this game.
Yeah, I saw that too, and I came in with an open mind, and when I played it, I realized how wrong that was. And you probably heard the news that people, there was a leak that Naughty Dog, apparently, yeah. They lost the main part. I was actually exposed to that leak, even though, you know, spoiler alert, I'm not going to mention anything right now. But I, you know, basically was expecting something to happen in part two that partially did, but that didn't take away anything for me. So
no,
yeah, that was a big problem with the launch.
Well, let's say at the beginning of this episode, spoiler alerts for The Last of Us and The Last of Us 2. We're going to really get into it. And to truly talk about the game, you kind of have to talk about its biggest character moments. So if you've not played the game yet, or if you don't, you know, want it to be spoiled or whatever, you can turn this off, play, then come back to it. But, you know, Abe, I always think of, isn't it Romeo and Juliet, like the first lines or something about Romeo and Juliet being dead? I always say, like, oh, fucking Shakespeare, what a hack. He spoiled it. Like, the idea of spoilers, I understand the feeling of wanting to be surprised by elements in a narrative. But at the same time, I think knowing when something happens doesn't necessarily change the way that you're going to consume it. It's still about how the characters react and the themes and all of that.
It's true. I think you do have to have some type of acceptance that you're already invested in the story and that nothing that you can possibly hear will change your experience.
Yeah.
That's the reality of it. But the expectation, I think, is... you know, kind of being surprised at a birthday party type of experience.
Yeah.
People think they're missing out on that. And well, the funny thing is I'm going to just say a big one right now because we have to get this out of the way of part two. That what happens to Joel really gives the rest of the game.
Wait, what happens to Joel?
Oh, well, he gets his face bashed in with a golf club.
What? How'd I miss that? Yeah, right? Man. The protagonist of the first game, the first game came out in 2013, and it was a huge hit. It is, I'll be straight up, it's the first and the second game, I don't think are that innovative in terms of gameplay, but I think they are heads and tails in terms of narrative. Maybe the best thing that's ever happened in the video game medium. Just the story, the characters, the acting, the dialogue. And part of that big first leak was the revelation that, oh, the protagonist of the first game, Joel, he actually dies early on in the second game. And you are kind of avenging him. And I think even before people even played the game, just when that came out, people got pissed.
That's right. I read that leak, unfortunately, way before the game came out, and then I embargoed myself to watching any trailers or video just so I can kind of get some freshness. But what's great is that actually happened early in the game.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And there was no anticipation factor for me where I'm constantly waiting what's going to happen. And that actually gave the rest of the game purpose.
Yes.
And it basically was the conflicting moment for all the characters. Before this game even started, this was based on some past experience, which I'm sure we'll talk about when we talk about Last of Us 1.
Yeah.
But there's lingering pain in the game, and you don't really know whether you're the bad guy or not most of the time. And
that's the beauty of it.
That makes people uncomfortable. They realize, you know, the person they've been rooting for might not actually be so good.
Yeah. I talk too much on my podcast about The Last Jedi. and I'm sure people are sick of me talking about it, but I can't help but compare this game in some ways to The Last Jedi, because I think one of the reasons why so many people were unhappy with that was they didn't like that Luke Skywalker's life was sad, that he didn't stay the hero that you wanted him to be, and that life was hard on him. And I think I think that people, you know, we live in a consumer world, and I think that people feel like to be entertained, you must be delighted, and that there's no value in being upset. Like, yes, in Last Jedi, the way we find Luke Skywalker, our hero, as this sad, dejected hermit is sad, but that's art. You can be, feel sad sometimes. Having Joel die is not just a trick or a gimmick. You know, sometimes you see these like YouTubers who do these essays, and I've watched a lot of the negative essays about Last of Us 2, and I hear so many people say this is a gimmick, and that makes no sense to me, because art is a gimmick. It's always a gimmick. Like, it's all contrived. How can you say, oh well, killing Joel is just meant to make you feel a certain way? Yeah, like that's a story. Like, there's nothing cheap about that.
Mm-hmm. And what are the consequences? And I guess, you know, this could sort of, we could do this in reverse, but what are the consequences to Joel's actions from the first game at the end?
Fucking huge.
Exactly. And the thing is, before he met Ellie, he was not a great person.
No.
He was almost even considered, like, if you thought about it in a way, a human trafficker, because one group was asking to transport a girl somewhere else, and he was willing to do it for money or for weapons or whatever it was they were pushing. So he's, and then actually what happens in the hospital, that kind of, you know, shows that you have to actually do this in the game. You actually kill the leader of the Fireflies as well as the doctor at the end of the first game. So you end the Fireflies and you end the potential for human salvation.
Yeah.
And you're just going to start a new game, and it's basically like, let's stay happy. Let's find a happy ending. I mean, it's
exactly.
Yeah. Joel definitely led us to this point.
Yes. All right. So let's kind of quickly, as much as we can, talk about the first game. The first game, which came out in 2013, is a actually, to be honest with you, it was a game I avoided because I often find myself kind of weary of zombie narratives, just because it's such a well-trotted field, but it's its own thing. The game, we play as Joel. Joel, in the beginning of the game, before the apocalypse happens, before there's a pandemic that ruins everything, Joel has a daughter, and in the cold opener of the first game, his daughter dies, which is sort of the game's first sort of emotional shock. And then we, through the credit sequence, we hear about everything that happens. There are terrorism, there's you know, everything crashes, blah, blah, blah. So then we find where years later, Joel is now, like you said, he's like this. Basically, he's like a drug runner, scumbag, sort of. He has survived by not being afraid to take other people's lives and to do whatever he has to do to survive. And he's completely closed off, especially after the loss of his daughter. And in the first game, there's this group called the Fireflies, which the police call terrorists, but the people call sort of revolutionaries. And some people think they're just fools. And they want Joel to transport this quote-unquote package from one place to another. And the package turns out to be Ellie, who is a 13-year-old girl. And Ellie is a kid. She doesn't know anything of the old world. She's grown up in this world. So she doesn't, you know, everything she knows of the world before the pandemic is all just sort of this abject history. And throughout the game, and the first game is great, although more simple, I think. Mm-hmm. I kind of think of the first game and the second game as like The Dark Knight and Batman Begins. Like, one is this perfect, concise story, and the second is this huge, grandiose epic.
Yeah. You know, but can I actually mention one thing is I'm a huge fan of Naughty Dog. And before even getting into the story of the first Last of Us, I was a huge fan of the Uncharted series.
I've actually never played those games.
So if I could give you a comparison, Uncharted is the Super Mario of PlayStation. So they basically moved consoles with this super good graphics, really good story, basically premium video gaming storytelling and actioning. And you had, you know, basically completely different combat. You had all the ammo you needed, all the grenades you needed. Last of Us was that completely stripped down and turned into this very dark, cold story.
Yeah.
So they took that, you know, blockbuster selling PlayStation understanding and they sort of refined it and then gave us this really good complex history with characters.
Yeah.
And different times telling us the story jumping around.
Yes.
Which, by the way, Joel's daughter was killed by soldiers.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people forget, you know, that maybe he took on Ellie because he lost his daughter. He took on Ellie because he, you know, humanity screwed him over.
Right.
So that really, you know, inspires him as a character, but just shows every character has this sort of, you know, really great story. And that really is from Naughty Dog's experience of making, you know, three or four of these premium titles for the PlayStation, which were exclusive. And I really recommend it to people because it's right. actually really, you know, a good colorful version, say, of The Last of Us. It looks very similar and has similar components. But yeah, it's a good, basically good start into a much darker genre, but a much more right. serious one that has social commentary and a whole bunch yeah. of other great stuff.
It seemed just from the, I haven't played those games, but just from The Last of Us, you could clearly see that it's narrative first, that it's not, their goal seems to be pushing the narrativity of the medium. So through the first game, through, you know, and it's many hours, through the trials and tribulations and all this stuff, Joel's heart sort of melts and he begins to actually care a lot for Ellie. Somewhere in the first game, he meets up with an old friend of his. I think his name is Bill. And Bill says, like, you know, Bill's completely alone. And he says, like, you know, don't care about people. That's how you get hurt. That's how you die in this world. If you give a shit about someone else, you die. Which really, that's what happens in part two, right? Joel, I guess I'm jumping ahead, but Joel wouldn't die if he hadn't saved Abby, mm-hmm. right? He saves Abby, then Abby goes on to kill him, and we'll get to that. So,
and there's a lot of that back and forth. I'll save you, and later on you save me, but right. we'll talk about that some more, I'm sure, with yeah. two. But yes.
The important thing, I think, to take out of part one is the end, because I think all of part two is predicated on the end of part one. Which is itself, I think, a groundbreaking thing, because you quote unquote beat the game, you win the game, you win your objective, yet any player with a conscience comes away feeling uncomfortable about it. You kind of feel like, yeah, I got what I wanted, but I don't feel good about it. Basically, Ellie, we haven't said this before, Ellie is immune. She's the only person that anyone has found that's been immune. She was bit by one of the infected, but never turned. She can breathe in the spores that kill other people. So they think this girl is the key to saving humanity. We can use her to create a vaccine. And finally, at the end of the journey, Joel delivers Ellie to the Fireflies who are running this hospital. And he finds out that to make the vaccine, Ellie has to die. They have to get something from within her brain, which there's no way to save her. And Joel now loves Ellie, and she's the only thing he cares about. And he fights and he saves her and he kills everyone. And you remember, these people are just trying to save the world.
These were trained doctors at a time where doctors were limited. There's right. no way to make new doctors. So it was a totally unethical and wrong for right. him to kill those people
right.
and not fiercely negotiate or at least talk to right. them about the consequences.
And by the way, though, when you're playing, you feel that. You feel like, no, I don't want Ellie to die. You feel with Joel. You know, I recently read a book that was really, really good. It's very hopeful if you're feeling down lately. It's called Humankind, A Hopeful History. And it is it's a beautiful book that kind of goes through history and philosophy and everything. And basically, the premise of the book is human beings are good. Human beings are good. They're not bad. But one of the interesting things in the book is they talk about empathy. And they say, you know what? Empathy is actually bad because empathy is a spotlight. So what's not within that spotlight, you don't care about. Joel cares about Ellie. That's all he cares about. And he wants Ellie to live because he loves her. And he doesn't care that he dooms the rest of humanity. And even the head of the Fireflies at the end of the first game tries to talk to him. And she's like, look, no one wants her to die. But think about a vaccine. What
obviously, can I mean, saving humanity or one person, it's but you know, it's interesting that you say all that because it kind of gives more meaning to the title, which is the us part. And who is that? Who is that? Who, like Last of Us, like who are the people that title represents?
Right.
And by externalizing, at least in the first one, the Fireflies, they're this external group.
Yeah.
And we're sort of operating in the fringes of the army and the Fireflies and different factions in the game. You don't know who you are, I guess. And,
right.
But it's interesting that you call empathy a spotlight, and that's exactly that, is that spotlight is, you know, sometimes it's big on its on a large group, sometimes it's on a small group of
right.
people. But not to get ahead of, you know, what we're saying, but, you know, the sequel definitely took that and ran.
Right.
And you had different parts of the game depending on which perspective, right. you know.
It's the trolley experiment or the trolley dilemma. If you've ever watched the NBC sitcom The Good Place, they talk a lot about this. It's a philosophical dilemma. Basically, you're on a trolley and the trolley is headed towards a group of five people. And if you don't do anything, you don't touch anything, you don't involve yourself at all, you will kill those five people. But there's a lever. And if you pull the lever, now you're involved. But the lever will change the track of the dolly and it'll hit one person. So either you do nothing and five people die, or you get involved and one person dies. But that one person is distinctly you decided to kill them. And I think that is what leads to what makes 2 unique. And we'll get to this in a minute. But what makes 2 unique is showing you the same story from two different sides.
Which was tough for people, which is one of the biggest criticisms.
That's what tears people
up. The number one thing I heard about is the complaints were that.
Right, exactly. So I guess to wrap up the first game, we save Ellie. And there's this amazing moment in the first game, which happens a lot in the second game, which is you're asked to do violence, but you don't want to, which for a video game, just think about the implications of that. Video games from the beginning, there's just arbitrary violence as conflict to move yourself through the game. And at the end of the first game, Joel busts into the operating room where they're about to open up Ellie and she'll die. And you can't leave the doctors. You must kill the doctors to finish the game. And one of the doctors cowers, unarmed, with her hands over her face. And you don't want to shoot her. But if you don't, the game will just pull you. You can't progress. For a video game to make you do violence and then make you feel bad about it, I think is extraordinary. That's extraordinary. And at the end, Joel and Ellie escape, and Ellie, even at that age, she knows something's up. She feels like something's wrong, and the end of the first game is she asks him, "Is what you told me the truth?" Because he told her, "Oh well, we got there, and guess what? There are other people who are immune, not just you, but they can't even do anything. It was all kind of a bust," which she doesn't totally get because she was unconscious, and then they're gone, and she's like, "Why did you pull me out when I was unconscious?" And you can tell at the end of the first game that she doesn't really believe him. When he says, "I swear, I'm telling you the truth," and you know that sin, that distrust is going to be the thing that the second game is about, and so then we have 7 years from between the first and the second game, and it becomes this huge hit, and people love it, and people can't wait for it.
But could we just talk about that for a second?
Please.
Because it took the objective of the game of a prior Naughty Dog game was you find an ancient relic and then you preserve it from some bandits who are stealing it. It's basically an Indiana Jones title.
Yeah,
that's the extent to which video games made tough decisions. They're really not there. And Last of Us constantly took away the possible satisfaction that you would get from making a decision and from being a character. You know, I noticed when I was playing the second one that it was just a moodier game.
Yeah.
And of just generally, normally games have these positive objectives of making things better. And because of the narrative and because of, you know, the actual setting and environment, it was actually like, this is not like a roller coaster. This is more like a downhill, a slow downhill descent into shit.
Right.
In the language. That, like, you know, how will this eventually turn into something that I think is going to be positive? And actually, I gave up on that when Joel was killed because I thought that was the pinnacle of any resolvement to the first one. I was like, okay, right, that's done. That's never getting resolved. We're at a point where we might be lower emotionally and the world is a little bit more darker, you know, and you kind of sense that some characters, you know, do get calloused as this
absolutely
story goes on.
Joel can play the guitar and he teaches Ellie to play guitar. And there's a moment, because there's a lot of flashbacks. It's very Quentin Tarantino the way that it bounces back and forth. And there's a scene where she's trying to play. She's learning to play. And he says, you just have to build up your calluses, which I think is so metaphorically true, because Joel has figured out a way to be closed off yet somehow just care about one person.
Yeah.
Or maybe a few, because he had given up on his brother and then he sort of brings his brother back into his life.
Yeah, I don't think he lets his demons get to him. He's able to live what he thinks is a good life without thinking that justice is ever going to make a difference. I think that's one thing that he's calloused.
Right.
And eventually the worst thing he ever does comes back to haunt him
right.
via Abby.
Right. And it's a selfish thing to save Ellie, but other people have made the argument that he's like, fuck humanity. What do I care? What do I care about a cure?
Well, could we also introduce Abby? Because I think that's the first time we talk about her now. I think we're talking about two. And
yeah.
you actually, for the first time, take control of Abby early on in part two, which is unusual. And people, I'm sure, also didn't like that because of her role in actually she's the murderer of Joel. But it happened to be she's the daughter of the doctor that he killed in that hospital.
Right, right. So the second game, we find them, how many years later? A couple years, 4 years later, something?
I think it's more. I think it's like 10 years. I could be wrong, I'm not sure. I think it might be a little bit longer than 7 years.
Ellie's a teenager now, and her and Joel and Joel's brother, they live in this community, Jackson, which is a nice, like, little, it feels like very much like a sort of Western frontier town. That is fortified, and the people have to go out and patrol just to protect their way of life. But it's not terrible inside. I mean, early on in the game is a way of teaching you the throw function. You play. You have like a snowball fight with some kids, and Ellie is she's a homosexual, which we actually learned from the DLC of the first game, which is called Left Behind. Which, have you played Left Behind?
I did not.
Okay, Left Behind's really interesting to go back because it introduces a couple things that are you see for the rest of the story. And so Ellie has like kind of like a girl that she likes, but that girl has a boyfriend. There's a kind of like a whole new group of like young characters. And her and Joel have grown apart a little bit, but not in any real – it's kind of like a teenage daughter and her father. You know what I mean? Like, there's a point where her uncle is like, you know, you need to say more to him than just hi and bye. You know, he really cares about you. And basically, while patrolling, right, like you said, in the beginning of the game, you switch off between playing as Ellie and playing as this new character, Abby. And we don't know anything about Abby. We're just thrown into her perspective. And we know that she's looking for someone, and we can assume that that's Joel, but we don't know why. And Abby's a really tough character. She's very physically fit. She's got these big, strong arms. And you're forced to play as her. And then a couple hours into the game, Abby's under attack when she's out, and Joel and his brother Tommy save her. And they introduce themselves, and Abby realizes...
She's under attack by 50 to 100 zombies.
Right.
Early in the game, and you're playing with her, and out of nowhere, Joel saves her. That's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It is. And Joel and Tommy introduce themselves, and to talk about acting in a video game, it's extraordinary. Like the moment where they introduce themselves, and you could see that she realizes this is the person she's been looking for, you just feel it in your gut as the player. And then she basically kills Joel. She tortures and kills him. She beats him slowly with a club, a golf club. And
They graphically depict violence in this game, and that's a big draw and adds a lot of value to the story too, because of the raw violence. It's not like a character can fall off a cliff or something. I mean, these characters typically experience very violent ends, and it sort of has this almost like Game of Thrones type of tension, where when a character dies, it could be very bad, which actually it hurt me when that happened, when Abby did that to Joel. I was like, it's so gruesome seeing it. But the game sort of just is a raw game that sort of gives you that experience. So that's a big part of the story too, that wasn't a great way for a guy that you played in the first game to go out.
It's not a dignified way to die. And we know him as this very strong hero, and he sort of is screaming in pain, and it's really hard to hear. And Ellie busts in on this, and she's held down, and she's sort of forced to watch him die. And after he's killed, you know, Ellie is screaming, and she's in pain, and we feel for her, right? At this point, we just remember the first game. We love Joel. We love Ellie. And this Abby character, who we barely know, we're like, this is a villain. This person is evil. She came into our lives, and she killed someone we love. And I think your ability to give that up is tied into your ability to like the second game, because the second game forces you for half of its runtime to play as Abby and to see Abby as a human being. And if you can never grow to forgive her a little bit, I think you'll never be satisfied with the game. And I think that's the problem for some people. So after Joel dies, the first half of the game is Ellie's like, well, I need revenge. It's a pretty simple revenge story. Ellie goes to Seattle, follows Abby. Abby is a WLF, a wolf.
Well, could I also say one thing that I think is worth noting is that one of Abby's associates wanted to kill Ellie and was really at the point of shooting her point blank.
Yes.
And this is not a spoiler, because this was one of the leaks when the game was leaking, was that also that Ellie dies. So that was a fake piece of information. There was a true piece of information, was that Joel dies. I heard both. So unfortunately, I was sort of confused. Yeah, but the point is that this team of Abby's team, they allow her to live. And that's sort of where the story starts again. And as you said, you play a part, you know, in the really early on as Abby. And I think that was a turnoff for people,
right?
Because of this, you're either Joel or you're Ellie. That's it. You know, that was Last of Us 1. And I think you felt that you immediately were given as branching off when you started playing 2.
Right.
That you sometimes are not going to be in charge of which side you're on.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a bold thing for them to do, because of the sort of the connection that you have if you played the first game to both two characters.
Yes.
So, and then when you get the sense that she's on the other side, and that Abby's, you know, male interest, Owen, he's one of the ones that also lets Ellie live. So we'll get to what happens to them as we talk about this some more, but it's a really interesting redemption that constantly goes back and forth. You know, these characters allowing each other to live.
Right. Well, going back to what you said about The Last of Us, it's like, who's us and who's them? You know, another way to think of empathy is as a circle, and how big is that circle? You know, we all have an empathy circle. We love our partners, we love our family, but we may not care about the animal we eat, or maybe we do. But you don't care about fish, or maybe you care about people in your country, but not in another country. It's always a circle, and who's in it and who's not in it. And I think this game's all about that. And yes, so it kind of goes the way you think it would go. She tracks down Abby, and then Abby gets sort of the jump on her, and the game stops. And then we go back 3 days, and we play that whole time that we just played as Ellie, now as Abby.
Well, and also, could I just mention one thing? And this is a revolutionary thing about the game, and you touched upon it. But the point between which you're doing the redemption story, you know, you're Ellie coming back to avenge Joel, there's a love relationship, Ellie and Dina. And that had to have been a moment that people were not comfortable with. And I don't mean people, I mean the dissenters that thought that this game was sort of sending too much social commentary.
Right. There's also a transgender character later on, which a lot of people don't like either.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So there's but that message you're left with, and you have to be acceptant with, and,
right.
and play the game while you're a partner with Dina. And that, there was that whole open world section where you do stuff with her, which is an awesome part of the game. And actually, in the Uncharted games, there were long stretches of the game where you had a partner. Right. But this game took it to another level and forced you to deal with, okay, if you're not comfortable with, you know, homosexual characters, we're going to put that here for you.
Right.
And you're going to have to accept their relationship, their bond. And eventually you just love Dina and Ellie as a couple. They become a really great power duo.
Right.
And then they have issues that are complex for a video game. These are issues that are dealing with sexuality and with, you know, parenthood and with gender roles. And Ellie is right in the middle of that.
Right.
And this is before we even get to the redemption part where Ellie's going after Abby. This is a complex story that's sort of unfolding, which I thought was amazing. I mean, you don't get that from games. You don't expect that type of social commentary or deep character building from a video game.
Right. Well, the thing, you know, the old saying is walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. And the functionality of any video game is you control an avatar. So you don't just identify with them the way you would identify with a protagonist in a book or a movie. You are literally becoming them. So this game makes you be characters you don't want to be. I mean, the big turn where now you're playing as Abby, like you said, early on you play as Abby a little bit and it's sort of it's an interesting, like, where am I going with this? But then when the game totally switches off to, now you're going to replay half the game as Abby and see what she went through. It's huge. We see flashbacks. We realize Abby's dad was the surgeon who was going to kill Ellie. But we see that none of them took that lightly. We see a whole scene where the head of the Fireflies is talking to the surgeon and he's like, is there any way we can save this girl? I don't want to do this. And you realize this decision was tough for everyone.
It made Joel's decisions feel way more small,
right?
And it kind of diminished his backstory when you heard what the other characters went through, especially the flashbacks between Abby and her dad, which they went through these extensive, really loving relationship of these human beings that Joel killed,
right?
And that's something that the game does to unsatisfy the last game, which is a challenging thing to do, but not our story. We're sort of taking a back seat and we're followed along through these experiences, you know, even as comfortable as they are.
You say it perfectly. It does not allow you satisfaction. And sometimes art is that. It's not satisfying to be told the person that you hate because they killed the person you love, they are a person too. And you know what? She killed him in a horrible way, but maybe she was right. I mean, listen. Once you learn who Abby is, and we see at the end, like I said, the end of the first game, you have to kill the doctors. We see in this game, Abby run into the room after they're all dead and she sees her father's dead. And think about Abby. Abby is this girl. She has this really wonderful father and her father has this beautiful skill and he wants to save the world. Her dad is going to save the world. He's a hero. And this guy kills her dad, not only dooming the world, but taking her away from him. Of course she hates Joel. You know, after Joel is killed, there's this really painful scene for us to watch where one of the other members of Abby's gang spits on Joel's corpse. And it's like, fuck you, burn in hell. And when we're watching it, we're furious. But then you go, of course, that's the guy who fucking ruined the world.
He technically did ruin the potential for the world.
And then I think what's really interesting is there's this whole nother subplot that comes in where there's this cult. This sort of militarized cult called the Seraphites, which the wolves, they call them Scars. And the Seraphites, it's almost like a recreation of part one because there's this young child that Abby takes under her wing and saves. And this is a transgender character. His name is Lev and he's a Seraphite, and he was biologically born a girl, and they have very strict gender roles in their, whatever, their religion, their ideology. And even though Lev was really young, he was going to be basically given to an elder as a wife, which is itself echoes things that couldn't happen. But Lev is transgender, and Lev shaves his head, which is a big sin for them, and they are outcast. But through the whole game, the wolves and the scars are enemies, and Abby is asked to, again, empathize with her enemy. She sees this kid, and even though she said, these kids, these are animals, they're barbarians, this kid needs help and needs saving, and she saves, and it puts her in a place where the other wolves are now going to be mad at her.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was the scene where they get introduced. I think Abby is actually in the process of being hung.
Yeah.
And she's about to die. And these individuals who are also being excommunicated, so to speak, from their cult. I mean, it is sort of like a cult where they have this figurative leader and they have their own ethos. They save her, because they recognize that, you know, she might have information, but she helps them at that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, by the time we get there, there's also this discovery that Dina is pregnant.
Yes.
And that is really interesting, because for, you know, Ellie to not obviously, you know, to be romantically involved and to think about this family and this future, and she then has to think more about her gender role and what that means as a protector or as somebody who's just, you know, out for vengeance. She constantly has to, you know, debate whether her life is about avenging Joel or if it's about planting her roots.
Right.
And the game, you know, really is, that's a touchy subject. That's a very sensitive and tough area.
Right.
But that all happens right as Abby and Ellie confront one another in the theater.
But we also have on the other side a pregnant person. And what's interesting is on both sides there are these new forms of family, not nuclear families, but families, you know, the hierarchy seems to have changed in this new world. And on the other side, Abby has her ex-boyfriend who she cares deeply for, Owen. And Owen has a new girlfriend or wife, Mel, and Mel is pregnant. So we have pregnant people on either side. And Mel is a doctor, and Mel helps people and saves people. When we play as Ellie, we end up killing Mel as on our way to find Abby.
And Owen.
But when we then play as Abby, we see that Mel and Owen are in the middle of really going out of the way to save Lev. And they're such good people. And even when we first start playing as Abby, we see that nobody's happy about what happened to Joel. They're having nightmares. Abby seems to be the only one who's dealing with it. But everyone else is like, man, what we did was really fucked up. And just even that alone is mind-blowing, that the so-called villains, we see them grappling with the violence that they did. Even though they feel like Joel is this worst, the worst person they could possibly be, they're all like, wow, I don't feel comfortable about what we did. Like, Mel won't even talk to Abby because she just feels like, after seeing Abby kill Joel, she's like, I don't want to be friends with this person.
And Ellie kills Mel, and Owen, who is, like we said, Abby's ex-boyfriend. So they were romantically involved, though, even after they were exes.
Right.
And the interesting thing is that's where the game, in my first time I've ever seen a sex scene with nudity.
Yeah.
In a video game.
So, yeah.
And that was sort of a big thing. I know it was just like, you know, a moment, but for a video game, it's a very challenging part that built this character. And then Ellie kills Owen and a pregnant Mel.
Right.
And that was a point in the game where I definitely felt like, okay, Ellie is not all up there.
No.
Or she's not guided by some type of compass that she's the good guy. And
right.
You know, if there was ever a time where you were confused about that, Last of Us 2 settled that several times for Ellie, where she technically takes part in some brutal actions.
Yeah. Well, there's a beautiful moment after she kills Owen and Mel. Mel is on the ground, and Ellie, like, I guess, notices for the first time that she has a stomach, and she unzips her coat, and she sees very clearly that Mel's pregnant, and then Ellie throws up. because she realizes, oh, I killed a pregnant person, and she starts to vomit. Which, again, think about violence in media or violence in video games. When's the last time you saw it, you were in a video game and you kill somebody? Like, Super Mario doesn't kill a Goomba and then throw up in revulsion of, oh my God, what have I done? You
know what I mean? No, the brutality was there. And actually, the way they treat each other, the way Elle, her reaction to Dina being pregnant was actually rejection. She said, you put us at stake or you put us in danger or something along those lines. And then she came back and realized, wow, not only is this happening, but I might be responsible. And then she winds up doing the worst thing someone could possibly do.
Yeah.
So I think at that point, I was actually starting to like Abby really early on in her story.
Yeah.
Because I thought to myself, I already understand that Ellie's path to the game, path to the hospital was driven through some type of, you know, story that people are committed to. But now it's about this larger human, you know, narrative that, you know, there's different roles that people play that are either helpful to humanity or hurtful. And I stopped thinking that Ellie was helpful when she started killing people. And then I thought, okay, Abby might be the next character to latch on to.
And some people have a real problem doing that. Some people truly hate this game. And you hear people say, it's manipulative. They forced me to play as Abby and try to make me care about Abby, and I don't. Which is fine. If you can't care about Abby, then I suppose you won't have any enjoyment from this game. And I would never say that, you know, the text is more complex than the reader of the text, but I would say try to see Abby's point of view. This brings me to something that's very controversial in the game, which is dogs. When you play as Ellie, the wolves, who are the military group that Abby's a part of, they use tracking dogs sometimes, and the dog can smell you. So if you're hiding in the grass, which is part of the stealth functionality of the game, you know, you're hiding in the grass from the humans, but the dog can smell you. So you have to get rid of the dog. Now, early on in the press, Naughty Dog said, oh, you can avoid the dogs, you don't have to kill them, which created some other controversy because people like, well, you kind of do. And I would agree, you kind of do have to kill the dogs. But then when you play as Abby, you see those same dogs and they're cute and you pet them and you play fetch with them. And then some people go, this is too much in terms of manipulation. First, you make me kill a dog, which is unpleasant. And then you rub in my face the dog later on when I'm Abby, and it's like, now I have to even humanize the dog that I just saw. What do you think of this? Let me ask you.
Well, I think the game constantly is, again, taking away the satisfaction of you being on the right side.
Yeah.
And that's one of those situations where, you know, when you're on Abby's side, you're actually have names for the dogs that are being used to kill Ellie. And when you're Ellie, as you said, that dog part becomes a gameplay component where the way you sneak around is all of a sudden different because these things can smell and they sort of come to you, which makes the gameplay much more tense.
Right.
But it feels wrong that you're shooting an animal and it's a pet. And then you're actually on the side that adores that. So
right.
the game is sort of intentionally knocking Ellie's framework for survival.
Yeah.
And it's making it's again taking away the humanity that via the choices that the character has to make. And I think it does that in numerous ways, that being one.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Also being a controversial one.
It's controversial, sure, because it's unpleasant to have to kill even a virtual animal. But going back to what I said earlier, I never call anything manipulative because narrative itself is manipulative, art itself is contrived. So to me, there's never a line where this is crossing the line of this is too much. You could even see it as furthering the point of us versus them because, you know, you have to kill the dog because the dog is killing you. The dog is aggressive and mean because the dog has been trained by the wolves to kill people who aren't wolves. So yes, when we are wolves, they're cute and they're playful and we can play fetch with them. But when you're Ellie, they are monstrous and they're trying to kill you.
The dog does become a weapon.
Yes, absolutely.
And I, you know, what's interesting is, again, this is such a deep, this thing to weigh is the how much is human violence worse than animal violence? And I think violence in general is such a difficult thing to grasp in this game, especially when it's, you know, it's very, realistically portrayed. I think it forces you to kind of accept that survival is tied to, you know, this morality, and for you to exist, for you to be a survivor, for you to keep the story moving forward, you have to constantly be a killer.
Yeah.
And all the characters by the end of The Last of Us 2 are so diminished and so worn and so damaged, and they all have stress, they all have PTSD. I think the game is constantly doing that. I don't think that the game is building up to something. I think the game is slowly a representation of this universe that's in decline and just getting worse and worse. And it is a little bit gloomy and sad and pessimistic, but it's very rich too. And the story, like as we're saying, you can see how much there is going on just by hearing, you know, kind of what we're talking about here.
You mentioned that the dogs all have names. Everybody has a name. Even the non-player characters have names. You know, when you kill a wolf member, you kill an NPC, some NPC will go, "Oh, Joe died. Oh, shit, look at Joe." Like, and sometimes it's funny. It's funny when you kill an NPC and then in stealth mode, and then you see another NPC find the body, and they're like, "Oh, no, they killed Bill. Bill's dead." But literally that happens... But it's interesting because there are no goons that are just nameless. Literally every person you kill, whether an NPC or not, has a name. And by the way, when you do kill the dogs, the NPCs really freak out. They're like, "Oh my God, you killed an animal."
If you kill an owner, the dog sadly looks around for its owner in like a little area as if it's confused. And that is so sad. But it's again, the game puts you in these uncomfortable situations over and over again. And it does it again, like with the best graphics you've ever seen in a video game, the best environments, the best, tech design. I know we didn't really talk about that too much, but I don't really have too much, foresight on that, but it is definitely one of the best looking games that has ever been made, probably.
Yeah.
And it's a fair send off to the PS4 as sort of this is the last year for the PS4's, reign.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it is a great looking game for a console that's been around,
Yeah.
So all this is happening in a very rich way.
Well, you know what? I think that's a good place for us to go. Before we get to the ending of the narrative, let's talk a little bit about its style, because I think this game is rich with texture and tone. And yes, it's very dour and it can be very depressing, but some of it I find actually hopeful. The game has multiple musical sequences. In the beginning, Joel sings a song to Ellie, which is, a way that he expresses to her how much she means to him. Later on, Ellie sings Aha's Take On Me, an acoustic version of Take On Me, to Dina, and the game lets it play out. I would actually... I would call the game itself acoustic, stylistically. Obviously, it's this video game. It's digital. It's technological. It's electronic. Yet something about the style of it is acoustic. There are these empty buildings and there's this bare scenery. It just it feels very textile. All the guitar sequences, I think, are just extraordinary.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because that can easily be overlooked. That, first of all, you actually play the guitar on the controller.
Yes.
You're given the chords and you strum, and there's some gameplay mechanic to get you invested in the performance.
Yeah.
And throughout the game, there's an overtone that Ellie's a songwriter, and she's continuing. And she was born after the apocalypse pretty much hit. So she's seeing Joel as this role model songwriter, and Joel wrote some beautiful songs that are played for her in the, throughout the course of the game.
Yeah.
So she carries his skill into the world. But the thing is, I play acoustic guitar myself. There's a melancholy to the guitar. There's a sadness to the man and a guitar alone. And Joel really takes that far. And Ellie eventually does that as well. She's writing lyrics. Like in her notes, you can see what she crosses out and what she agrees with. And it's all a reflection of the reality, the harsh reality that they live in. So I could see what you mean by there's hope there. It's the fact that they're telling the story and they're showing showing us this part of it, and they're making us also play with it for these extended periods. It is a very, I guess, mature way to tell a story in a video game. It's almost like a diversion, but it's kind of like, this is more about story building and world building and you know, kind of touching on feelings of you know, the things people are going through there.
And it says something, I think, about expression in their world. Their world is so hard and filled with such violence. Joel, and then he passes down to Ellie this tool of expressing yourself through song. Because Joel is like an old cowboy. He, you know, I don't think he ever even says the words, I love you, ever to Ellie. But we know that he does. And I think when Ellie plays Take On Me for Dina, she's telling Dina that she loves her. I guess to me, the most beautiful scene is the planetarium.
Yeah, that was actually, that was a, they went into depth on that story arc. And it's interesting because the theme of space is used throughout the game as sort of this distant thing of this distant thing when people had imaginations. But
Ellie says, like, back before everything happened, like, it's crazy that you guys just went to space because you wanted to.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks to her desire, one, to get to a better place, but two, to, like, work together. You know what I mean? Like, because what is space exploration? Because she's also very much into science fiction. She also collects, like, basically they're like Marvel cards.
Yeah.
Like the old 90s Marvel cards. So she's into sci-fi and fantasy, and I think she's into this idea of, like, you know, if we can just, like, work together and go somewhere else. But, you know, what's interesting is the scene in the planetarium, which is, it's not necessary for the plot, but it's so important for character. Basically, it's Ellie's birthday, and this is a flashback, so this is, she's younger again. Joel takes her, he's like, I got something special for you for your birthday, and he found a natural history museum. And first of all, she also loves dinosaurs, so she's so excited to see dinosaurs and they go into this, like, I guess it's a replica of, like, a space shuttle, which now, you know, in this world, everything's abandoned, so you can kind of do anything. So he goes, put on a helmet. So she picks a helmet, and she puts it on, and they sit in the space shuttle. And then Joel, for her birthday, he gives her this cassette, and on the cassette is the audio recording of a launch. And he goes, put it in she has, like, a Walkman, and he's like, close your eyes. And she closes her eyes, and she gets to, in that moment, imagine being in a craft that is leaving the atmosphere. And when her eyes close, we even, like, see her imagination, because the screen begins to shake, and we see, like, this yellow-orange light on her face as if she's actually really leaving the atmosphere. It's, like, it's this very sort of surreal moment that's very beautiful, where it's, like, we enter her imagination. And it shows so much their bond. And who she could be if she could give up on the hate.
On hating him for his decision, which she'll eventually... it's interesting because that, to me, obviously is this, as you mentioned, this character-building diversion, but it really creates this sort of sadness that the world isn't like that anymore, and this is the closest she'll get to the world that Joel lived in.
Yes.
I also thought that it was a highlight for Joel that this was one of the best memories that he had of Ellie and his influence and his, you know, father-like, you know, character role playing out. But, you know, the rest of the story doesn't give us that satisfaction that they have a healthy relationship, especially when what happens, unfortunately, happens to him. It's such a strong diversion to a sad story. A really, really sad story.
I think that's another really brave, interesting theme that the game does, because they're not perfect father and daughter before his death. Their relationship is strained. She doesn't trust him that much. We learn in a flashback that she gets him to admit what happened. And he admits it, and she really is like, you took this away from me. I don't know. I'll never forgive you for this. And we see how much that hurts him. So it's not like their relationship is perfect before his death. It's already complicated. And actually, I think it's a very interesting thing that the game does, which is we think throughout the first half of the game that Ellie doesn't know the truth. But then when Abby confronts her in the middle of the game and we switch to Abby's point of view, Ellie says, I know why you killed Joel, but it's, and then we as the viewer are like, wait, she does know? And then we see a flashback where she learns the truth, which is, again, another interesting narrative sort of, maybe trick's not the right word, but it's a narrative journey. You know, a lot of people were upset because, well, during the reviewing phase of the publicity, reviewers and critics were not allowed to play as Abby. So a lot of them didn't even know that that was a point. And some consumers were like, oh, you lied to us. Because there are scenes in the trailer that are not in the game that imply that Joel lives throughout the whole thing. To me, I think, well, that's just to preserve the surprise. People who are like, oh, Naughty Dog lied to us. It's like, well, what do you...
That is marketing?
Yeah.
You're mad at the marketing. You know, when you're watching a movie, it's in an enclosed container, beginning, middle, end. Nothing outside of that is going to factor into whether you like it or not. But I think, and we should mention this for 1 second, just my own social commentary is that, you know, the state of the online, the state of gaming, of the gaming community when it comes to reviewing stuff is not good. The consensus is not always right. It could be right a lot of the time. But as you can see, you know, Last of Us initially, I mean, I think enough people played it now that there's overwhelming consensus that it's a good game. But the first week or so, there was a brigade of people that were saying all sorts of stuff that
there was review bombing.
There was that. Obviously, there was that too.
Yeah.
But you know, but like gamers in general are very particular. They're not well equipped for diverse changes to either, you know, the way things are done in video games. You know, there's always something that could be done better. You know, not that many games get the credit they deserve because there's this overwhelming perfectionism as opposed to sort of stand back and be the viewer instead of thinking that you're making the game. So that was a big problem that I think, you know, was widespread.
Even bringing it outside of video games, what do you think about the current state of media consumption and fandom? Because we've got this game, we've got Star Wars The Last Jedi, we've got the last season of Game of Thrones, which people started petitions to remake it. We have Sonic the Hedgehog, where people didn't like the design, so we literally bullied the company into redesigning it. Where are we at right now where fans feel like they can own things? I don't know how. What do you think about this?
Honestly, I mean, I am not someone who has ever had to, sell a creative work. But if this were happening to me, I would think of it as being held hostage.
Yeah.
To some type of populism, where instead of thinking I could be creative and free and write the story or tell it how I want to tell it, there's this potential mob that if 25% of people on the internet, just 25%, think that this is total shit,
right?
That's enough to sway the opinion because they review bomb. You know, they'll give it millions of people will give it a 1 star because they're invested in how much it sucks.
Right.
And that really sucks. Instead of us having a debate about why things are good, and if they're not, they just don't get talked about.
Right.
We talk more about why things are bad.
Yeah.
And that sort of puts more attention, spotlight, and, you know, pot stirring, so to speak, on the bad stuff. And that, I think, has a lot to do with this stuff, with review bombing and the way that the culture works.
And it gets very scary. Laura Bailey is the actress who plays Abby. And this actress has been getting death threats since the game came out. And this reminds me of Kelly Marie Tran, who played Rose in The Last Jedi. She also got death threats. These fans that when they don't like a character will threaten the actual actress. It's always an actress who plays the character. It's even if you hate a character, you're gonna send a death threat to the actor who plays it? It's madness to me.
It is, and it's probably from people. Look, you are not a Naughty Dog fan if you're writing a hate letter to an actor in that made the game.
Right.
Because the whole point of Naughty Dog games are this wild creativity, this infinite amount of artistry. They have so many good things going for them that to harass someone you know, that works for them, that made one of their products, you don't really know this. I mean, it's a troll army of less informed fans. Let's just put it that way. And I don't mean to really call people out, because everyone deserves to be heard, whether or not you like, you know, Last of Us 2. But at the same time, you know, the level of vitriol and hate, and personal attacks. And then also blanketly saying Last of Us 2 sucks because of one thing that you don't like,
right,
is not an assessment. It's not a true, you know, portrayal of what is good or bad about the game. Just saying something sucks is not that.
It's also, it feels like for so much of, so many of the people who are part of fandom, you know, think of themselves as having really discerning tastes and being able to really understand art and media. Yet sometimes I think they don't, because some of these people, I feel like they have really been informed by sort of capitalist consumerism, you know, where they think it's like a Yelp review, where it's like, okay, you don't like the game because the way it made you feel. That doesn't mean that you then get to like go on a campaign against it. I mean, you can, because you have a voice and you have speech, but this idea, it's not like you bought like a vacuum and the vacuum doesn't work. You bought a video game and it made you feel sad and it made you feel weird about violence. That's like saying, I don't like Van Gogh because it makes me feel bad about nature. You know what I mean? It's like, well, fucking, that's part of what it is. That's what it's trying to do. Not everything is just meant to tickle you. Not everything is meant to make you feel happy.
You know, one of the hardest things for the launch of Last of Us was the leak that Joel dies. So before the game ever came out, anyone who didn't like that was the initial body of people that looked for any other reason to dislike the game.
But right, without even having played it.
But that was the core foundation. Without even playing the game, they knew this was why they were going to hate the game. This is why Last of Us sucks. I was in group chats of people that said they wanted to break the game, you know, midway through the game. And I sort of, you know, let that be. But, you know, I can't really fully support anyone who doesn't like the game because it doesn't tell their story. That can't be your criticism. It's like not liking the ending to any movie that has an ending. But as we mentioned in the story, and we're going to talk about the ending of Last of Us 2, as we mentioned, the story is told from so many different time perspectives, and it doesn't give you the satisfaction of knowing what you need to know all the time. So again, you have to let, you know, you have to kind of sit back and observe and experience the world that they built, and go through what the characters are going through, instead of just sort of following along this potential optimistic story that, you know, might have a happy ending. It doesn't.
Well, let's get back into the narrative. After we've played Abby's sort of the retelling of those 3 days in Seattle from Addie's point of view, we come back to this meetup between Abby and Ellie, and they have a fight, and Abby can kill Ellie, but doesn't. Lets her go again. And then seemingly the game could be over. And then we see Ellie living with Dina and Dina's child, who they're raising together in this farmhouse. There's a scene where she goes out to the tractor and you see the grain, the wheat or whatever, and it's just golden and it's moving in the wind, and it's, you see the sunset and you see like she has this beautiful life here.
That was one of the most beautiful scenes I've ever seen in a Naughty Dog game. Not just Last of Us, but in any Naughty Dog game. That was such a beautiful scene, which, as you said, that game could have ended there. That Abby was like, you know, I'll let you go. And, you know, after their conflict, or Ellie just accepted the loss. Right. But the point is she's a part of this, you know, what looks like a nuclear family now.
Yeah.
And it looks like, you know, heaven on earth.
Right. But we want the game to end there. We want it. We go, part of us goes, all right, just end here. Just be done. Be happy. You know, like, because there's these scenes where, like, they're dancing together as a family, and it's like, what a nice little, it's sort moment. Of like future or past. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then Joel's brother, Tommy, comes in, and Tommy's this perfect representation of what what hate does to you, because he's so beat up. He has, like, a fucked up face because he got shot in the face, and he's limping. And he comes in and he's just consumed, and he lost his wife due to his hate.
She left him, actually.
Left him, right.
Yeah.
he won't give it up. And he comes into Ellie's beautiful family and he's like, come on, I know where Abby is. We can go get her. And Dina's like, we're done with this now. But Ellie has PTSD, and I think she thinks maybe killing Abby will give her what she wants, which is so sad because you as the player know that's not true. And when she leaves, Dina's like, don't leave. And she's like, well, I have to. And she goes, if you leave, you can't come back. And it's so painful because that's when you're really like, Ellie, you don't want her to go.
You know, and the game was 100% about revenge. It was never more about revenge at that point. And it was really, like we said, they built such a wonderful landscape. But can I just say, the way that this game tells a story, you know, from moment to moment is so rich.
Yeah.
At that point when basically you're holding Jesse, the father of Dina's baby.
Who dies along the way. We haven't talked about him yet, but he passes.
He gets killed at that confrontation at the movie theater. And he gets brutally. Almost like, just in a brutal way.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is, she is holding that baby. She's corralling some sheep into a barn. There's this beautiful scene going on. And then a crate falls. And the sound of that crate gave Ellie this PTSD of seeing Joel's brutalized face in a close-up way. And she has this panic attack. And it was a very scary moment in the game where she's just like breathing heavy after such a beautiful moment. And that's one of the things that inspires her to take up the advice where Abby's going and go there. And she leaves Dina in the process, which was so heartbreaking moment in the game.
But you bring up something interesting, which is the game does something where multiple times we see both Abby and Ellie have nightmares, and they both repeat the same nightmare, which is losing their father. We replay Ellie's dream of when Joel's being killed, he's being killed in the basement of this home. Ellie hears Joel screaming and she runs down the stairs and finds the door and it opens it. And we have that nightmare repeated. But when we play as Abby, we have Abby in the Firefly hospital from the first game running and finding her father dead in the surgery. And that repeats. So they're similar.
And it's funny because when Ellie's about to do something terrible, there'll be a flashback to Joel. Like she sees Joel and she'll be like, I guess there's some type of rationale that this is why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Right.
It's for vengeance. It's for him. And Abby does the same thing where she's in that hospital room where she found her father killed by Joel. And whenever something messed up happens in Abby's character arc, then we see that. But what's interesting is that what happens to Ellie in that barn is a deciding moment where after everything is fine and dandy, and as you're like, please game, just end right here and everything will be great. She has this vision, and that's how powerful it was, that it was sort of like it brought us back into the story.
Yeah. I'm going to do something that I've never done before on my podcast, which is quote the Bible. This is from the King James Version of the Bible, Proverbs 11:29. He that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind. And I know that quote from the classic movie, Inherit the Wind. And the idea of that quote is, you'll get what you win is nothing. Like not to skip ahead, but at the end of the journey, at the very end, Ellie goes back to the house and it's gone. Dina's gone. The baby's gone. Everything is gone. And this empty house is all Ellie has. And that's it. She's inherited the wind. It's just, you get nothing from not giving it up.
That was one of the coldest moments I ever felt in a game.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most empty moments I ever felt in a game.
Because part of you hoped maybe Dina didn't go. Maybe Dina will be waiting for her.
That's what was wrong. Not wrong, but I mean, that's what we had to go through as playable characters, right? If we were an actor in a movie, you know, going through every room looking for a sign of Dina is not something that they would do for a feature-length film. But as a character, I was looking for any sign of Dina I could find in that house. I felt like I missed out on something when I came back there. And I wanted it to be a part of that picturesque, you know, scene that we saw again. But that was gone. And that was brutal. That was really tough for a gamer, you know. Call of Duty, you know, I play a lot more simpler games than Last of Us, you know, to deal with. It was actually a lot, and it hurt. And there was a lot of parts of the game that hurt too, as we'll talk about, you know, as we get into the ending. But that was one of the last things you see in the game, though, is what you just mentioned, is this empty house where it was once a warm home for a growing family. Very sad.
It is a very sad game. So Ellie decides that she does decide to leave Dina in this beautiful, happy ending that she could have had and track down Abby. Abby and Lev, the Seraphite child that she has saved along her journey, they hear rumors that the Fireflies might still exist. So they're looking for this faction of Fireflies. But on their journey looking for the Fireflies, they get ambushed by this other militarized group and taken captive.
And they're like a human eating. This is in Santa Barbara. The rumor was that the Fireflies are back and they're in Santa Barbara. And Abby, who's a part of the group that Joel ended by killing their leadership and those doctors, wants to rejoin with them in Santa Barbara.
Right.
And she hears a rumor, so she goes down there, but she gets captured by these. They're a cannibal human eating group. So and the game kind of tells you that, but you have
There's cannibalism in the first game as well.
Yeah.
It's a very, I mean, I think that could happen. I mean, what, you know what I mean? Like it seems so savage, but.
Well, if you've ever seen, I don't know if you've ever seen The Road, but I've read The Road by Cormac MacArthur.
I haven't, no.
A No Country for Old Men writer. And basically he tells a bleak story of this post-apocalyptic world where it's just a father and son traveling along this road on a hunch that they might find salvation. And they come across a cannibalistic group of people that stand by the road and, you know, try to harvest people's meat. But the theme of cannibalism, you know, is sort of like the bottom of the bottomless pit where morale is or isn't. And it's like eating another person's worse than killing a person. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
And you think killing someone's bad, eating them is worse. So that's like the like, you know, kind of the part of the game where it really gets dark, but Ellie goes back there. So Abby goes to this place in Santa Barbara, and then Ellie goes, she gets a hunch that that's where Abby's going. So she goes after her, but Abby's captured.
And she finds where Abby is captured, and she goes and infiltrates and actually sets loose all the captives.
She's looking for Abby.
And we then get to this really striking visual where they say, Abby, she's not here. Some of the captives were taken down to the beach. And we go down to the beach. And by the way, Ellie has sustained an injury. So Ellie is like barely moving. She's in pain and she's holding her side, but she's just being driven by this desire to find Abby. And we find Abby basically crucified. We see on the beach a bunch of poles with captives who have been strung up and nails were put through their feet. And we see Abby, who through the whole game was so strong and big, she's obviously been starved and she's dying.
Looks like a different person.
Yeah, and she opens her eyes and sees Ellie, and she's like, it's you. And then Ellie lets her down, actually. And Abby doesn't even start fighting her. Abby just goes to save Lev and wants to leave. And then Ellie's like, well, we have to fight. And Abby's like, why? Why do we have to fight? Like, look where we are.
And it's funny you say that, because basically it was a very biblical looking scene.
Yes.
And the hypocrisy here is the failure in Ellie's thinking is she has a life sustaining injury. She risked her life to come to this place.
Yeah.
Find and kill Abby. And then when she sees her standing, she can just leave her up there. She doesn't even have to do anything and she's dead. And so would Lev. She instead lets them down as if though she cares about them in some type of weird way. Right. And then before they actually encounter one another, as you say, Ellie's like, we have to do this. And Abby's like, what for? What's the point?
Right.
And they're both exhausted on the verge of death. Yeah. And that's actually a really sad part of the game. I I felt real emotion there because I felt so conflicted that Abby was so hurt. She looks like a completely different person and I'm hunting her as Ellie and I don't want to do this. Like there were parts in that final encounter where I didn't want to press the button.
Right. The game forces us character. To fight.
Yes.
The game forces us to fight, but we don't want to. And I tried just not touching anything and nothing. The game forces you to fight and you, and it's interesting because you've played so, you care about them both now. So you're playing as Ellie and you have to press the button to hit Abby, but you think, I don't want to hit Abby. I love Abby and I love, can't you guys see, you're the last two people on Earth. Can't you see that?
And you know what the toughest part was they were fighting in like a shallow water, like 2 feet of water. So every time somebody fell, it just took a little head dunk to suffocate them.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, is the game this brutal?
I'm going to play
the role of somebody who kills somebody that I was playing as. I mean, I guess it's like killing yourself almost.
Yeah.
But I felt a real emotion where it was just, that was like, you know, there were a few times in the game where I got teary eyed and that was actually one of them where I just felt like she just was about to die.
Yeah.
And now Ellie's going to die and she's going to kill, you know, out of spite, her enemy.
Right.
It was tough.
They actually have out an official Last of Us 2 podcast that Sony's been putting out, which is sort of a making of the game. And one of the developers of the game said, in another world, Abby and Ellie would be friends. They have so much in common and they're so bound to one another. Like you said, the way she lets her down, she doesn't. She could just leave her there. Abby's just about dead, but she lets her down and
there were other dead people on the poles.
Yeah.
So they had to have been sitting there for days.
Yeah.
And it was because Abby's such a strong figure. She actually physically has she looks like a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
And you see her skinny and disheveled, and this kid the Seraphite kid that she's been taking along with her, that she saved, is also on the verge of death. And it feels so petty to go after them. And as I was following them, because it happens like near a beach, you follow them to the water and they're Abby's just trying to walk away, get on this thing and not talk or look at Ellie. And Ellie's like, we have to do this. And it's just petty. And I felt so bad. I'm like, don't do every step I took forward was like, it felt wrong. Like, don't do this.
And they're both half dead. They're both injured. Even as a just as a fight, it's slow and it's so painful. Ellie has this move where she always has a knife where she will swipe at Abby's arms and cut her, and it's so just they're just stinging each other and it's so painful. And eventually, Ellie is on top of Abby and drowning her, and she gets a vision of Joel alive with his guitar in front of his home, and Ellie stops and lets Abby go. And again, some critics of the game say, oh my God, I just killed 300 people to get here and now I let her go. I understand that point of view, but that's the ending. Like, I mean, if you did kill Abby, it would make the game even more just sad and depressing. I think there's something hopeful in that she lets her go.
I think that's the happiest thing that could have possibly happened.
Yeah.
I was very content with that ending.
Yeah.
Just knowing that they both experienced so much loss that they were, I guess, they were forgiving themselves by forgiving each other. I think that's really where Ellie was coming from, was she forgave herself for everything she did wrong.
Yeah.
Because she obviously felt guilty and she let that go. By letting Abby live. And after that scene, they go to the, and this is one thing that I think is one of the final parts of the game. When she goes back to the empty house, her room of stuff is still fully stocked.
Right. So
somebody moved out, but they left her stuff. And the worst type of breakup kind of feeling kind of way, this house is empty and it's just Ellie's stuff. She picks up the guitar. She plays a song. And then before she leaves the house, she leaves the guitar on the window.
Yeah.
And she doesn't put it back in the case. She just leaves it on the window. And that was a very pessimistic, that was not a very like happy thing. I thought she was letting Joel die by, in a way. She was letting the guitar become, you know, potentially damaged by nature, and rot. And she just left the house. And I got the sense that she closed that chapter of her life, that it was no longer Dina, no longer Joel even. But I was actually pleased at the same time that A, she got to live, and B, that Abby also got to live. I thought that was a really great wrap up for the story, as dark as it was.
Well, thinking about that last moment, she puts the guitar down and the camera tilts up and we see out the window and we see the field of grain and it's sort of out of focus. And then we see Ellie walking through it as she's leaving the house, and the sort of out of focus kind of can be read as like her future's out of focus. It's unclear. But as sad and down as that is, I still found something hopeful in that. Because I think after all this pain, after losing so much, I think Ellie now is ready for peace. And that could just be my optimistic read of it.
Well, is the game over? You know, is the story done? Do we deserve a sequel? Right? I don't think we do.
I can't imagine. I mean, of course it's possible, but I can't imagine more.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't think we deserved Last of Us 2. I think it's such a great game, and it was released into such a crappy environment that, like, unfortunately, video games don't have the best story or the best character building. And they spent so much time on that. That's what I mean, is they sold that to an audience that didn't want it. It was basically like gourmet food for little kids. And I was so entitled. I felt it was such a pleasure to play that game. I don't think the way that this was released, I don't think we deserve a third one without it being some type of controversy or some issues related to it. But if they did do a third one, Abby did make radio communication with someone in Utah, which is the city where actually her father died, or the state. It was in Salt Lake City in Last of Us 1. And apparently the Fireflies have regrouped and are back in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And remember that radio communication at the end of the game before she gets captured.
Right.
And then all of a sudden that story goes blank. So it's very possible that Ellie potentially discovers them in the future, or Abby discovers them in the future, or that's where she's going next. She's going to Salt Lake City. The game did leave us something.
Right.
But I don't think we're worthy of it. So, I mean, I just think the way that it was interpreted and handled, I think it deserves more acclaim and more attention than it's gotten.
I think the sort of, in a nutshell, it's a violent video game that makes you question the value of violence. And I think a lot of the consumers really didn't like that. And, you know, it's hard because there are some critics of it, but then there's also straight up bigoted people, which you try to separate them, but it's hard because they infect one another. You know, there are the people that review bomb it and hate it just because Ellie is homosexual or Lev is transgendered. And they go, oh, this is woke SJW bullshit, which to me is such nonsense. It's divisive. I think it's going to continue to be divisive.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of female empowerment in Last of Us 2, you know, surpassed most movies. Let's just put it that way. Where, you know, Hollywood, you know, these are my views. These are expressly my views. Hollywood has a history of being male centric with leads and stories and that kind of thing.
Right.
And this game is not only representing females and women in this story dominate. They're in all of the positions of leadership in The Last of Us are women.
Yeah.
But it also puts the gamer has to accept that women are in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And that transgendered people are a people, and that sexuality can be as fluid as someone wants it to be, and that's the normal thing for that game, and it's not a normal thing for, you know, gamers and in mass, you know, like the general population of gamers that don't get any exposure like that. So I don't think there's an agenda. I think that the game is basically telling a rich story with real characters instead of this generic action Rambo type story, which 90% of games are, you know, about.
So let me ask you, have you played the game Days Gone?
No.
Days Gone, which I actually played before I played Last of Us and Last of Us 2, has, I think, a very rich story, and it takes a lot from The Last of Us. And it's also an open world. Mm-hmm. If you want another sort of story like that, I would suggest Days Gone.
You know what's interesting, though? And I've heard you say this on the podcast, and I heard you say it on this podcast. I too don't like zombies. I don't like the concept of zombies. It's funny, we've talked about this for this long, and now I say this, but it's just that I think that it makes me uncomfortable. And the reason why I played Last of Us was because it was a Naughty Dog game, the first one. I was like, this is an adventure. This is going to be rich storytelling. It just so happens there's zombies. That's why I haven't played Days Gone yet. They just kind of creep me out in a way. But I could pick it up and try. I mean, again, it's a new thing that games get rich storytelling, as much as we've been blessed to have in recent years, like Red Dead Redemption, this game and other Uncharted or Naughty Dog games have all had really good storytelling, but it's still not that much. And there's still a lot more that's needed for, like, you know, big games, which we only see one or two of, you know, every 5 years.
We're on the precipice of a new generation. We've got PS5 coming, and I'm excited. I'm excited for, you know, what's to come.
I am too. I have to tell you this because I'm really into virtual reality. I have a PlayStation VR. I have a huge library of PlayStation VR games. I've followed VR games from when they were like crappy little half-hour experiences to what they have now, which now they have like open-world Walking Dead games for VR. So I think, you know, PS5 is going to absolutely do that. It's going to handle that. You're going to expect to see games told from that perspective too. And I'm excited for PS5 just as a 2D, you know, 3D game. But playing a Last of Us VR experience could do some more, at least in terms of engagement and storytelling. And we're so close. We've had PS4 for like, you know, I don't know how many years. I think it came out in 2013, 7 years. So it's by far one of my favorite consoles of all time, but we're here. But PS5 is happening, and it's already seemed successful. It's crazy how much people are excited for it and like are really like all about getting it.
You know, when it comes to video games, you know, we people our age have experienced something that, you know, somebody living at the turn of the last century experienced with cinema. You know, in our lifetime, Abe, we've gone from video games being, you know, electronic puzzles to fully fleshed out narrative, almost like interactive novels. And there's always some resistance from some people, but it's just so exciting to see where it goes.
You know, it's a creative battle versus a economic or a business battle. I think what you see is game makers don't get budgets, or creative game makers don't get budgets for games that are not going to sell like hotcakes. So what sells like hotcakes? Open world games that have mindless story that are just empty maps. So as good as PS5 ever is, it still needs studios like Naughty Dog making games. Otherwise, we're just going to have a huge amount of Call of Duties of you know, that type of thing, as opposed to these rich works of art like, you know, Red Dead, GTAs, and Last of Us, of course.
All right, I think we did it. My guest today was Abe Farage. Abe, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I am a huge gamer geek, and you cover it on your podcast from time to time, so always happy to be on and help out with this.
Thank you so much. We end every episode by saying go bye-bye.